Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today, we have a show that reflects my very, very early research interests when I was in college. But before we do that, I want to take a minute, as I usually do, to request funds from my friends and supporters. My tax issues are, you know, far worse than I had thought. I don't know what the problem is here, but unfortunately they're reaching crisis levels. Must have made some error somewhere. I don't know, but or it could have been a divorce related thing. I have no clue. But anyway, whatever you can spare, my friends, I will thank you. And for those who've already given, you have my eternal friendship. When I was stable many years ago, I gave to so many nationalists who needed it, because that's how we work. And also, even beyond my problems, whether it be personal or financial, the fact that I give away this insight, which is almost completely original, for free, is something that's worth a few donations, I would think. And I'm proud to say that I have changed the face of nationalism in America. I brought Russia and Putin into front center and have spawned an entire new generation of Russian Orthodox nationalists. And all of these pages, these young guys saying pretty much the same things I am, you know, it's not a coincidence. And I am the originator of that, and I wish they would cite me a little bit more. But otherwise, I'm gratified to see the effect that I've had, and I thank all my listeners for supporting me. This has been an ongoing project, and but many years ago, when I was in college, I founded the University of Hartford's chapter of the National Traditionalist Caucus. It was a New York-based group, and I got into a lot of trouble because I named it after General Suharto of Indonesia. And as always, you know, you name anything after an anti-communist, and you're in a lot of trouble at a university. Every military leader who is an anti-communist is accused of slaughtering innocent people for no reason. And it's something that I'm really sick and tired of, the notion that soldiers will just go into a village and start massacring kids. It simply doesn't happen, as I've said before. That's, you know, those stories are war propaganda. And there isn't a single anti-communist military leader that's not accused of this. And something happened on October 18th of this year, 2017, that got me extremely upset, that there were declassified documents in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, allegedly proving that the U.S. knew the slaughter of 500,000 innocent civilians in 1966, 65-66, the year of his coup. I read every word of those 39 documents, and none of that is even mentioned. And yet every major news source on the planet, in English, says that we have proof that this man is capable of did this, and he is evil, and anti-communism was evil, etc. Now, why are we talking about Indonesia? Well, I was, you know, a freshman, sophomore in college. This was my big thing. Hafez al-Assad in Syria and Suharto in Indonesia. Those were my two major influences in world politics. At the time, you know, Hafez al-Assad was, you know, condemned by the right because he was a Soviet client. And today, of course, the Assad family is looked at by nationalists in a very positive way. Again, that's also because of me, and I wrote the first paper on that in 1991. concerning the military development of the Syrian Arab Republic. But remember, Indonesia is the world's fourth largest country by population. It was also a major priority for Mao Zedong's China. Whatever direction Indonesia went, the rest of Southeast Asia would have followed. To have the world's fourth largest country fall to Maoism would have changed the world radically. I admire General Suharto and named my chapter of the NTC after him because he saved Indonesia from becoming a part of the Chinese Empire. If you want to consider what this really would have been, just consider a huge pan-Asian Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge. And that's what this would have caused. General Suharto is one of the most heroic men of the 20th century for this reason. Had Indonesia fallen with its oil wealth, with its mineral wealth, rubber, tin, other metals, there's no question that the Philippines would have fallen, that Malaysia and Singapore would have fallen. That would be tremendous pressure on the rest of Southeast Asia. And it would have been a huge base for both Soviet and Chinese communism. And God knows the millions that would have been killed. But I seem to be on a kick recently. I think there's a lot of these anti-communist leaders, these military men from Latin America or Asia, who no one knows about, no one studies. If you look them up online, you'll see nothing but ritualistic condemnations. But then if you actually try to get to know them, you see what they truly are. And they all have a tendency to be from poverty. They are strong populists. They're strong nationalists. They're strong social nationalists. And these are usually quite successful, especially in Asia, economically and politically. So the American press, starting in 1966-67, started the rumor that the army, for no good reason, slaughtered 500,000 or more innocent civilians due to anti-communist hysteria. Again, it's the same thing. It just shows you what these people wanted. They wanted the Vietnamese or Cambodian state all over Asia. And you know what that would have been. If you need any instruction, you can go to Dead Kennedys and listen to Holiday in Cambodia. If that's not enough, you know, you could contact me and I could fill you in on the rest. But what General Suharto did is save Asia from becoming like Cambodia. And the fourth largest country in the world from losing quite a bit of its population. There are so many of these national socialists or social nationalist military leaders of the 20th century who are just assaulted and attacked by the ridiculous American with big journalists or academic establishment that refuses to understand them. He's condemned because he stood in the way of global Marxism, period. Indonesia has oil, as I've said before, this huge population. This man is an extraordinary hero. And not only did he crush the communist movement, but he then created a very prosperous Indonesia, which is very close to coming to first world status because of his work. Like everything else, it's a blank spot on the American mind. As you know, Johnson's Law really fits in here because, as I mentioned, these alleged documents that have been declassified on October 18th, 2017, do not say that 500,000 were slaughtered. And yet this is the headline in every newspaper. There is no English language newspaper that doesn't say that. It's proven that the U.S. Embassy was behind the slaughter of millions of anti-communists, millions of communists in Indonesia. The American Embassy was part of it. They knew about it. These cables prove it. What is Johnson's Law? Johnson's Law says that the more obscure a country, the more errors are going to creep into any reporting or writing about it. A similar formulation is that the more obscure the country, the more incentive to lie about it for ideological purposes, because there's very few people who can correct you. You could pretty much say anything about General Suharto. You could say that he claimed to have gone to the moon, and people don't know any better. They don't know him at all, so they'll believe you. Well, here you have a case of complete and total fraud. I think the guy's name was Doug Simpson at George Washington University, who collated these recently declassified documents and lied. He says in his introduction that this is, you know, these are these prove that the U.S. And the Indonesian military slaughtered 500,000 anti-communists for no reason. The cables say nothing of the kind, and they hope that no one bothers to read them. General Suharto, and by the way, Indonesians only have one name, you know, like Bono or Prince, you know. General Suharto, you know, is no different than every other anti-communist military leader of the 20th century. He's immediately and without any knowledge at all accused of corruption, slaughter, for no reason. And only for that one reason. He stood in the way of global Marxism, although in the case of Suharto, it was a huge roadblock. And I'll say it again. Soldiers don't kill innocent people for no reason. All of those claims need to be deeply analyzed with a great degree of skepticism. General Suharto fought a low-level civil war with the Indonesian Communist Party, whose initials are PKI. The PKI had about 3 million members in 1965. They were being supplied by the Chinese and, to some extent, the Soviets. And they had been used in military operations by the outgoing president, Sukarno, who, one of these guys who tried to be all things to all men and failed. But he had leaned far to the left. And so the PKI was one of his partners in ruling Indonesia. So they were part of the ruling elite. The result of that is that scholars will say that, oh, that proves that they're a peaceful party. Well, sure, that's easy if they're already, you know, sharing power. But we know that Maoists and Stalinists don't share power. They were using him. He was an Indonesian Alexander Kerensky. And when their strength had reached a certain point, and the economy had gotten so bad that then they would stage an uprising and take over the country. Now, in 1966, when Suharto took over from Sukarno, the Indonesian economy was an absolute disaster. There was no economic growth. Inflation was 1,000% a month. The currency was worthless. No one wanted to invest there. And there was no hope for the future. And even more, there is no unity in the country. Indonesia is about 20,000 islands, and it's difficult to bring these different peoples together. In 1965, the PKI was the third largest in the world, and it had a military wing, like all communist parties do, and it was directed personally by the premier of China, Zhou Enlai. And under Sukarno, he certainly permitted the PKI to train. It had a military wing, and more importantly, they had tremendous influence over the Air Force and the Navy. In September of 1965, there was an abortive coup in which six army generals were shot. Now, the role directly of the communists in taking power then is being debated. There is no purpose to a communist party other than taking power. So obviously they wanted to take power. Their precise role in this abortive coup still remains unclear. But having 3 million members in an armed wing, you're safe to say that they had everything to do with it. And they would have been one of the great beneficiaries of it. The PKI, like any communist group, will not share power for long. But you have to understand, and this is where scholarship, due to Johnson's Law, fails constantly. In the 1950s, Chinese trained communists had taken over the civil service. In the 1960s, the Marines and the Air Force were heavily infiltrated. And this is Maoism, although Stalinism had influence. It was going to be a province of the Maoist Empire. There were clashes between the army and the communist militias. Under Colonel Saro Wibowo. And in the 60s, he had taken parts of Java, which is the most populous part of Indonesia, to create a civil war, which is what they wanted. They were heavily armed, heavily well organized, and because of Chinese support, had all of the logistic support that they needed. In 1965, everyone knew what Mao's Cultural Revolution was all about. Everyone knew the tens of millions that were killed by the Red Guards. This means that the future of millions of people are directly at stake. This is extremely, but you read these stories and, the army was raping children for fun, because they were fueled by anti-communist propaganda. As I've said 1,001 times, the U.S. did not fight the Soviet Union during the Cold War based on ideological concerns. But this is at a time, the U.S. was just getting started in Vietnam. The U.S. was far from anti-communist. The diplomatic cables that just were took over the international news sections in October of this year, it's really one of the worst, most blatant proofs of fraud in the media that I've ever come across. One of the things that the communists would do, and this was very typical, especially the so-called Popular Front movement, is that because this is a third world, they claim to be nationalists. Some of them even claim to be Islamic, because Indonesia is an Islamic country, although very different from the Middle East. Now, of course, there's no such thing. You can't be a communist and be a nationalist at the same time. It doesn't make sense. Because of that, you have this well-organized, foreign-funded party fighting for higher wages and on a national socialist basis. And so, yes, it was growing. It simply doesn't mean that they were doctrinaire Marxists, though. It is true that PKI members were killed by the army in 1966, but that was because a civil war had developed. And the people who were involved in the killings were not regular military, but Islamic cells throughout Indonesia who had taken it upon themselves to rid the country of communists. In fact, the cables from the U.S. Embassy in 66 explicitly state that the army was trying to calm tensions, trying to stop the Muslims from just slaughtering people. One of the great frauds here is a scholar named John Russo, typical professor up in Canada somewhere. And we're going to deal with him a bit later, but he's one of the people promoting this notion that the PKI was this peaceful thing and they never wanted power and they weren't armed and China had no interest in taking over, the world's fourth largest country, which is essentially his argument. Army estimates put it at about 78,000 of their opponents were killed in fierce fighting. And they were also fighting their own Marine Corps as well as armed PKI units throughout the islands. But of course, that makes a hell of a lot more sense than slaughtering 500,000 people for nothing. What a prize Indonesia would have been for China. It was a high priority for both the Chinese and the Soviet Union. It would be this massive, would be the crown jewel of their empire in Southeast Asia. So let's make fun of the authorities who want to tell you that this great man who saved Indonesia from Maoism slaughtered, for no reason, 500,000 people. There's a group out there, you may have heard of them, called the International People's Tribunal. Now, they rent out some space near The Hague in the Netherlands. So when you cite them, you can actually say, the tribunal court at The Hague condemns so-and-so. It sounds like, yeah, that's why they're there, because they can now associate The Hague with the in the public mind. The People's Tribunal has no connection with any government body or any court whatsoever. They like being associated with The Hague, but they're not that court. But that's the only reason they're there. I don't know if it's a restaurant or something they met. But the People's Tribunal is nothing more than a handful of European communist cranks with very little, with absolutely no official capacity whatsoever. Obviously, with the People's Tribunal in the name, they're a far-left organization. And they have issued their report, their authoritative verdict on what happened in 1966. So, but again, they have nothing to do with The Hague. They have nothing to do with any government body. There are a handful of university professors and leftists who actually want to be considered as an actual court. Now, they wanted to have a real trial. Now, of course, their minds were made up already, but very few of their witnesses were actually there at the time. You can't pay any attention to what they're saying. Their witnesses are expert witnesses, not eyewitnesses. And they demanded that the Indonesian army send a defense counsel to defend their position. They were informed that governments don't normally send representatives to debate a group of private people pretending to be a court. So the army's position was never heard. There was no defense. Nevertheless, they still call this an authoritative verdict. And I even heard media people say The Hague has condemned Indonesia for the events of 1966. So, but it is a fraud. It is a theater of the absurd. And they didn't question whether or not there were massacres. They said, because there's no documents that say that there weren't massacres, they definitely occurred. The question is who supported it and why. Now, this is the level of logic we're dealing with here. And everyone there, most everyone there, had no connection with Indonesia whatsoever. But, you know, without any ability to cross-examine these people, you can't ask questions like, why would these soldiers, almost all of whom had just fought the Dutch for independence, kill innocent people? No normal soldier wants to kill enemies, let alone their own innocent population. Even those militant veterans shudder when they speak of killing actual armed, trained enemies. Yet these men slaughtered for fun. Why would the army outrage the public like this? Do they just enjoy being hated? Or how about a question like, is knowledge of the Chinese Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward, is that relevant here? And what about the Chinese assistance to the communists? Or the communist takeover of the Marine Corps? Of course, none of this is mentioned, none of this is asked. Indonesia had just won its independence shortly before from the Dutch. And as is often the case, the army is made up of those veterans in that war. So the link between the people and the army is always very close in these circumstances. And we're to believe that the army wanted to destroy that bond by slaughtering innocent people for no reason. No army slaughters for no purpose. Now, this report it's just they deal mostly with international rights law. They have nothing to do with any factual evidence. In fact, they admit that there weren't a whole lot of journalists there at the time. So this is all extrapolation. They often conflate those in prison with those who have been killed. Johnson's law states that they don't have to worry about it because there's very few people who are going to be, you know, arguing against them. So they could say as they please. The fact is that in 1965 and 1966, you had a Weimar period in Indonesia. The economy was falling apart. Sukarno had no plan to deal with it. He was ineffectual. He was trying to be all things to all people. And the Communist Party was his main coalition partner. What happened, of course, was the army had responded to a very well-organized communist corps. There were other entities, of course. But this is what the army was dealing with. So in typical leftist fashion, the tribunal's report is this arrogant, pseudo-official statement of a few foreign leftists that the U.S., assisting the Indonesian military at a time, they just gave them some small arms and training, therefore was behind these mass killings. But the U.S. supported the army under Sukarno, too. And that angered the Dutch, who were NATO members. Now, of course, if it's a civil war, that's another matter. But certainly the U.S. gave no large-scale support to Indonesia. And I'll say this one more time. Had Sukarno taken over, the USSR or China would have taken this huge nation. All of Southeast Asia would fall. You would have one big Pan-Asian Cambodia. Even Japan would have been under pressure because of this. And I want to say something else to, you know, any of my enemies who might be listening. You know, in this particular case, you have these foreign leftists. You're well-paid and comfortable. And how dare you pass judgment on men making life and death decisions on the brink of a civil war? You know, you guys live a privileged, wealthy 1% life. You've never made any decisions like this. And you dare condemn those who did. Then to have this kangaroo court that has no defense and then claims an authoritative verdict that has the gall to demand action as a result of it. But of course, this kind of fraud is exactly what they were condemning the Indonesians for. Well, the 39 documents from 1965 and 1966 are very brief. Most of them are very brief diplomatic cables. And the New York Times wrote as a headline that 500,000 were killed, and this is proof of it. Document number 18 states explicitly that there that Islamic imams were demanding that anyone who joins the PKI should be killed. This wasn't the army. These documents, almost every one, mentioned communist defeats, that is, losses in war. The whole point of a communist party is to be armed and to eventually take power. Document number 24 talks about purges in the Air Force. In other words, the PKI had penetrated the military. The Chinese communists were working closely with the PKI. Now, document 33 says something interesting because it says that there are some leftist missionaries from Europe that were spreading rumors that millions of people were being slaughtered. And the cable says that we have absolutely no evidence that that's the case. And they state very clearly, again, document number 33, that the army wanted calm, which is usually what armies want. Now, it's true. Document 34 speaks of an army clampdown. But in 1965, there was an attempted coup. These generals were killed. The PKI were far more violent than, you know, they had bombed government offices in the area. And they also say that they had strong local support. They even say that the Islamic groups want a caliphate in Indonesia, document number 36. The very last document, 39, Ambassador Green says that he's trying to figure out Suharto's support, and he says it's roughly about 45%, with Sukarno in the low 30s and going way down. The head of the Communist Party was Deepa Agit, who was killed in this war in 1965. He was going back and forth to Peking for years. Essentially, was his main job. Now, it's common, in actually every article on this subject, the PKI wanted a peaceful transition to communism. Well, sure, and that was actually possible under Sukarno. It doesn't mean they were peaceful. They don't share power. a general, Nasution, had his daughter, infant daughter, killed by a PKI bomb in August. It was at her funeral where the generals swore their revenge. This is the incident that led to the killings of some PKI functionaries. There's a guy, the authority on Indonesian communism is Rex Mortimer, who wrote Indonesian Communism Under Sukarno in 1974, Cornell University Press. And he strongly, he's obviously a leftist himself, takes issue with some of his fellow leftists' fakery on this absolutely essential question. Mortimer states this. Let me quote him here. It is generally agreed that, particularly in East Java and Bali, where in proportion to the population the death toll appears to have been heaviest, communal tensions exacerbated by land reform conflicts of 64 and 65 and other political feuds go far to explain the scale of the slaughter. Until studies of the episode are made at the village and small town level, the nature of what happened, what was involved, will not be fully understood. Well, those studies had never been done. And Mortimer is very sympathetic to the PKI. Now, there is one damning document 30 states that the army is delivering PKI members to the Muslims for execution. Now, it also says that the army was trying to stop, you know, these senseless slaughters of unarmed people. Document 20 says this. Many of the atrocity stories that are being invented seem mostly designed to make continuing atrocities against rival political factions in Indonesia following the abortive September 30th coup seem less reprehensible. There's ellipses. Army leaders seem inclined to work towards the eventual dismantlement of confrontation. End quote. Now, but this is what the man, Brad Simpson, I'm sorry, I misstated his name. Brad Simpson says this. This is his introduction to these diplomatic cables. The U.S. government had detailed knowledge that the Indonesian army was conducting a campaign of mass murder against the country's Communist Party starting in 1965, according to newly declassified documents posted today by the National Security Archive at the George Washington University. The new materials further show that diplomats in Jakarta's embassy kept a record of which PKI leaders were being executed, and that U.S. officials actively supported Indonesian army efforts to destroy the country's left-leaning labor movement. Now, I could say one of two things. Either he's just very lazy and didn't read these, or he's simply a liar and a fraud. And John Russo, of course, is a curator of this collection. Here's what the documents reveal. Number one, that the U.S. was neutral on the Army's actions. They didn't know Suharto would be pro-American or not. They weren't that knowledgeable about all these different factions in the military at the time. Number two, there were no mass killings of any kind. And what I mean by that are in the thousands and thousands. Number three, there are killings mentioned, but they're almost always mentioned as part of a low-level civil war. Number four, the U.S. was convinced that Mao was a major part of this war. And of course, nothing could have been of greater interest to him than having this huge country fall. Number five, the population was doing the killing. The army was pleading for peace. Six, the army had no interest in a massive civil war, though the Chinese did. Seven, the army was delivering PKI members to the Muslims to be killed. But the numbers cited are 10 or 15, not thousands. The U.S. heard these atrocity stories, but no evidence has surfaced about them. And finally, that Sukarno himself was divorced from the realities of social life. He had completely failed as a leader, and this coup was almost an inevitability. The U.S. supported Sukarno, and had suspicions about Suharto. So what you have here, to give a brief summary, is you have this huge country that's on the brink of civil war. If it fell to the communists, the PKI, you would have probably all of Asia all of East Asia in a way, fall to the Chinese. The communists were extremely large and well-armed and had taken over units in the Air Force and the Marine Corps, as well as the civil service. The economy was completely tanking. So if something didn't happen soon, you would have a disaster far worse than anything that Suharto was ever even accused of. Even if he is guilty of these atrocities, which of course he's not, it's still far better than what Mao would have done with the country. The big issue that people want to bring up here is, what was the communist, the PKI's role in the coup of September 30th? There are two coups we're talking about here. The first one was an attempt to bring the communists to power. That's where six generals were killed. It was abortive. In fact, I shouldn't say that. You're not even sure what the goals were. It was completely abortive. The generals were killed. A baby was killed, as I mentioned, and that was at her funeral was the these guys had plotted revenge against the PKI. Now, Joseph Davies is a career army veteran that's published a three-volume analysis of the Indonesian army. And he writes the following. Few Indonesian leaders denied PKI involvement, even surviving party officials. Observers have noted factionalism within the PKI Politburo. Pro-Moscow Politburo, Sudirman, was still at large in September of 1966 when he published a written commentary maintaining the PKI leadership had grown soft and compromising under Sukarno, and criticizing party adventurism for involving itself with the September 30th movement, that is, the coup. He effectively admitted the PKI completely PKI complicity. Separate Chinese and Soviet Communist Party postmortems criticized the PKI for its participation in the adventurous conspiracy. Chinese leaders, including both Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, publicly chastised the PKI for assuming a position subordinate to the national bourgeoisie and for launching an urban putsch rather than a grassroots proletariat revolution. So you have the global expert, the world's expert on the Indonesian army, saying it's very clear that the September 30th coup was promoted, at least to a great degree, by the Communist Party of Indonesia, which obviously had both Chinese and Soviet support, mostly Chinese support, and that both the Soviets and the Chinese had a problem with this. It was too early for this. The coup wasn't just communists. That's why they called it adventurism, assuming a position subordinate to the national bourgeoisie. It needed to be a purely communist coup. But clearly, they were the motive force of it. And both Moscow and Peking fully admit that here. But of course, it's no surprise that academics will hold Maoists innocent for violence. But the establishment academics, other than Davies himself, say that the PKI was purely peaceful and had no interest in revolution. They weren't communists, I guess. But why wouldn't they be interested in revolution? They were a huge organization, deep into the military apparatus. They had promises of Chinese aid. The Chinese were promoting a coup to bring Peking closer to Jakarta. Yet readers are told that the PKI was just a peaceful group. Well, then they aren't communists then. That's how idiotic these people are. There's a more balanced view, though. Actually, my favorite writer on Indonesia, Vatikiotis, who writes the following about these events, really about Suharto in general. To say that Suharto was a dictator is again simplistic. Suharto always defined himself as a servant of the state, which endorsed him with a mandate six times since 1968. He has argued in the March 11th, 1966 order transferring power to him from Sukarno was not a coup. Instead, after convening a special session of the assembly in 1966, Suharto spent almost 2 years working conspicuously through constitutional means to have himself appointed president. Apart from the fragile, tentative nature of his power in the months after the October 1965 events, Suharto and those promoting him were also conscious of setting a dangerous precedent for the future by removing Sukarno by force. That's not normally how genocidal maniacs operate. He also says that, oddly, there is little material evidence in the form or film or photographs or anything else of these kind of atrocities. Some may have been exaggerated accounts given by communists and those sympathetic with them. Indeed, it says something about the intrinsic relationship between rulers and the rule in Indonesia, that residual feelings about this period have not cooled popular perceptions of Suharto's rule. It's amazing how few pictures actually exist of these alleged atrocities. You would think that with 500,000 people killed for no reason, that these piles of bodies would have eventually been photographed by somebody. They were not. Well, I mentioned John Russo. John Russo is an intellectually dishonest man. He wrote the book Pretext for Mass Murder, The September 30th Movement and Suharto's Coup in Indonesia. He, of course, is one of the big promoters that hundreds of thousands were killed. And he gets that from a group of foreign journalists that toured the country for a few weeks. And he doesn't tell us how they arrived at this number. So again, Johnson's law is in full effect here. Because really, despite how important Indonesia is, not a whole lot of people who are going to really check these things. Keep in mind, too, that the PKI, the Communist Party, was completely foreign. The founder was Henk Swillet, who was the Dutch founder of the Communist Party. Had 100 leading members in 1920, all but three were foreign. The party was completely foreign. Or pretending that they're nationalists is, you know, absurd. Swillet came from an upper-class background. He also, by the way, was involved in forming the Communist Party of China. And one of the members of his circle was Queen Juliana of the Netherlands. Yes, it's true. The PKI was founded by the elites of European society. But as early as 1917, the communists were heavily armed and organized. Russo and others deny this without any evidence. They proclaimed the People's Republic of Indonesia as early as 1948. And when that failed, they pretended to be nationalists after that. In 1955, they gained about 10% of the votes in an election. And yet they controlled huge chunks of the unions and the military. You could have 3 million members, that doesn't mean they're all doctrinaire communists. In late 1964, there was the Merba Party, which was an offshoot of the communists that became their rivals, was warning the government that the PKI was planning a coup. True to form, the PKI demanded the Merba Party be banned. So you have other communists who were saying that the communists were taking over in 1965. The PKI called for an arming of the people, which had Sukarno's support. Remember, people always means party comrades, not random citizens. And yet some idiot, Seymour Topping from the New York Times, says, "There's no substantial evidence that the communists had large supplies of weapons or were planning a mass nationwide uprising to seize total power in the near future." Well, what were the 3 million members for? Either they're communists or they're not. The whole point of a communist party is to take over by force. And by the mid-60s, Indonesia was quite dependent on the USSR and China. They were sick and tired of sharing power. They had every reason to be a part of this coup, and they most certainly were. John Russo uses actual PKI members who survived as authorities on this. And people like Rick Leafs, who wrote A History of Modern Indonesia, says that the PKI, a foreign group, was importing arms from China for the sake of this revolution. The army didn't kill people for fun. It was a shootout. It was a civil war. The so-called Fifth Armed Force was the PKI's militant wing, which no one denies. In 1958, the communists fully supported the suppression of the what was a right-wing revolutionary government of the Republic of Indonesia. So if they ever get banned or, you know, harmed in any way, it's just a taste of their own medicine. They've done it before. The communists also demanded the banning of the Socialist Party of Indonesia. Ultimately, we're talking about a low-level civil war in which about 70,000 people were killed. These are members of this Fifth Armed Force, whatever it is. These aren't innocent civilians. The Indonesian army grew under Soviet patronage in the early 60s. And Sukarno had already purged the army of right-wingers, as Kanboy and Morrison write in their book. Sukarno's ideology, you know, I mentioned Sukarno was trying to be all things to all men. You know, his ideology is called, you know, the term is Nasikam. And in English, it would be nationalism, religion, and communism. Now, I don't know. And the incoherence is deliberate. But it permitted the PKI to grow and arm itself under the law without any problem. Remember, the Great Leap Forward, which was China's collectivization drive, killed roughly 20 million people. You got, you know, Yu's and Gang and Tao Yang, who put it at maybe 50 million. And of course, the economy collapsed. But this might be the reason why the PKI was hunted at some point. They wanted to impose this system on Indonesia. People like Rusa claiming that 3 million armed party cadres under both Chinese and Soviet direction are a peaceful political party, you know, makes him either an idiot or a liar, or both. So in 1965, as the economy is clearly collapsing, and Sukarno is living in his own little world, the PKI are arming itself intensely, training at one of the big Air Force bases nearby, near the capital, and clearly had made inroads. And Sukarno actually had PKI members lecture to the army. Mortimer states this clearly. They had an indoctrination scheme for the armed forces. And they wanted to, you know, bring the army brass into the communist worldview, and, you know, include them in the process of revolution. So the PKI was both a legitimate part of the political system in the sense that they weren't underground, but they also, and they were being sponsored by a man who clearly didn't understand them. But there was a tremendous animus against the PKI by the officer corps. Any coup against Sukarno, who absolutely had to go, would automatically mean a war with the communists. I mean, 1948 is, you know, was a shootout in between the communists and the army. They had the support of the Air Force and the Marines. They had penetrated into the government. They controlled the labor movement. They were armed, and many of them had combat experience. 3 million members in 1965, and they were screaming for purges of the army. They were already getting ready to put Mao's ideology into action. General Suharto did nothing wrong. He fought a civil war in 1966, and he slaughtered nobody. The left was just angry because this massive country didn't become communist. 1965, it was either the Great Leap Forward or an army coup. The press, the American CIA, and the academics all prefer Mao. Suharto prevented the mass famine the communists perpetrated in China, and this makes him a hero. Rather, they've made him into this plastic villain. Now, the time we have left, I want to talk about what's really essential to developing countries, and that's the economy. Suharto's economic policies, as all National Socialists were, was a resounding success. In 1973, the GDP per capita was $1,500. In 1990, it was $2,500. That's taking inflation into account. After 1966, you had Western capital flow into the country, which was unfortunately necessary for development. Industrial output increased, including steel, aluminum, cement, food, textiles, cigarettes. Oil and gas, of course, increased this. And he took these new revenues from the oil exports and plowed them back into infrastructure. And I'm willing to say that that's better than Mao's Cultural Revolution. Between 1972 and 1982, it was unparalleled growth in the country. The so-called old order under Sukarno. It was economic chaos. There was only small economic growth at the time. But you had macroeconomic instability, no foreign investment, and bureaucratic corruption. And he, you know, was an anti-colonialist, but he had he was becoming dependent on the USSR. So the country was becoming just an aid junkie. It always makes me laugh when, Suharto had built all of these universities throughout the country, and the student protest movement comes from universities that he built, and they come from wealthy families that were made possible by the guy they're protesting against. But by the mid-1960s, the economy was a total disaster. And a lot of it had to do with a lack of stability internally. And he was absolutely a miserable failure by 1965. This is why military coups are popular. Per capita income fell sharply between 63 and 65. I'm talking about 1,000, 5,000% inflation. But none of the People's Tribunal or Arusa or any of these people don't bother to mention that the country was coming apart at the seams. And yet Suharto, being a national socialist, stabilized the economy and unified the nation, which is hard to do when you're a country of a million islands. He did rejoin the IMF and liberalized some FDI laws, but that was only temporary. He was anti-colonialist, of course, and was wary of this, but it had to be done. And yet, the public sector played a huge role in the economy. They undertook substantial public investments in regional development, social development, infrastructure, heavy industry. Then, of course, import substitution industries, which went against the IMF. So there came a time where he and the IMF were at war. Between 1967 and 1982, economic growth never fell under 6%. He wanted to spend money on domestic development. He didn't want foreign investment to make Indonesia dependent. And he was a protectionist, as any nationalist would be. So he created the infrastructure for an independent, modern economy, and healthcare and education went through the roof. Of course, the typical policy preferences of a genocidal maniac. Put it this way. Between 1988 and 1991, Indonesia's gross domestic product grew by an average of 9% a year. Between 91 and 94, that slowed down to about 7.3%, which is extraordinary for the third world. I'm going to quote Vatikiotis again on the economy. As foreign investment and lucrative oil revenues flowed in, much neglected services and infrastructure were installed. This, of course, is after the coup. Widespread poverty, estimated to have afflicted 60% of the population in 1967, began to recede. Per capita income began to rise above the $260 it was in 1970, and by 1980 it was over $500. The infrastructure of basic health and education facilities began to fan out from the center, laying the basis for one of the highest primary school enrollment rates in the developing world, 93% in 1987. The most crucial of these was the beginning of an intensive food production program, one that set Indonesia on a course to basic food self-sufficiency by the early 80s. Indonesia under Suharto was being held up as a model for third world development. A net show of growth, comparatively little social unrest, and the absence of tanks in the streets is enough to qualify for laurels in many regions of the world. In Indonesia, state-managed economic development since the 70s, against considerable odds, steadily improved the welfare of the majority of Indonesian people. Specifically, Indonesia have been singled out for deploying groundbreaking programs of population control and food self-sufficiency. Production of rice, the staple food, grew at a rate unparalleled in Asia. Between 1960 and 1980, the per capita production of rice went from 95 kilograms to 142 kilograms. Rice production has increased 50% since 1970. Despite a run of prolonged dry seasons. Per capita income increased 15% in the first few years of his rule. That's almost unheard of. He used protectionism to ensure Indonesia would not become a dependent economy. He demanded, just like Chung Hee Park in Korea, the diversification of the economy. From 1977 to 87, non-oil products as a percentage of exports went from 31 to 50%. GDP per capita grew 545% from 1970 to 1980. Apparently this is a genocidal maniac in the eyes of the academics and the frauds. Immediately after Suharto took power, the economy began to stabilize. From 65 to 75, domestic investment grew by 300%, and their savings rate in 1980 was 30%. Now, you can't blame this on oil prices, because oil is not a huge part of the Indonesian economy, and prices were flat in those years. This is what social nationalism will do. And as always, great men, Chung Hee Park, General Suharto, Chiang Kai-shek, are called genocidal maniacs. It really bothers me when every major news outlet in English said a couple months ago that the declassification of those diplomatic cables proved that Suharto, in league with the U.S., slaughtered 500,000 innocent people. You just have to skim these to realize that that's not said anywhere, not even implied anywhere. The opposite is said there. And no one has challenged it. No one has said a word. Mass genocide is something that is leveled against every anti-communist ruler of any strength. It's based on nothing except anger and ideological bias. Indonesia will not be a part of Mao's empire. Suharto kept all of Southeast Asia from falling into the hands of Mao Zedong. The Communist Party was huge, armed, and violent, because that's what Communist parties are. They were on the verge of starting a civil war, and the coup that attempted to create their own state was a communist coup in 1965. They killed 5 army generals, and General Suharto, in a counter coup, took over a year later. 65-66 was when this unrest took place. So, I should say, not a year later, it's the same, 1966, same period. Actually, very, very shortly. But the confusion always is that because he wasn't a dictator right away. For several years, he worked within a constitutional framework. I know it's difficult studying this stuff because you have two guys, only have one name, that sounds similar, Sukarno and Suharto. But they couldn't be more different. But when you have every major newspaper saying that we've uncovered these documents that say that the United States was complicit in the slaughters of 500,000 people for no reason in Indonesia, and they're right here in these documents, they're assuming that no one's going to bother to read them. Now, I know how, I guess I have this unexplained naivete with me that they wouldn't lie that blatantly. But even a skim, these documents prove that they say nothing of the kind. And yet that was the headline in October 18th of this very year, my birthday of this year. That was the headline in every international news section on the planet. And it's a blatant lie. And people like Simpson and Russo are liars. And they know that they're liars. They're frauds. They need to be removed from their positions, as are all these journalists that are reporting that these documents say that you know, the innocent communists were slaughtered and that the communists weren't armed and they didn't want power. I mean, this is how bad they are. This is what they're saying. I'll say this one more time. Indonesia is the world's fourth largest country. Had it fallen to Mao Zedong, you would have had a very, very different world. Japan even may have fallen. All of Asia would be under Mao's control. One man, a man who is a firm nationalist, or a social nationalist ideologically speaking at heart, took over and with a firm hand took over the army and purged it of communists and leftists and fought a civil war for a few weeks with armed communist groups as well as military groups. The Islamic movement was also an ally of the army at the time. And the communists were unpopular. They only had won 10% of the vote a few years earlier. And so the PKI claimed to be nationalists, so all of a sudden they start getting votes. They were armed, and both Peking and Moscow say that the coup in 1965 was of their own making. So Russo is aware of that, therefore he's a liar. General Suharto is a great man. The lives he saved are uncountable, probably. What could have happened if Indonesia and the Philippines and Malaysia and Singapore had fallen under Mao's control is unspeakable. Rather, Indonesia is now on the verge of first world status. He saved the economy, he saved the population, and he saved millions and millions of lives. Whatever prosperity Indonesia has today, and it's pretty substantial, is because of him. And his enemies, like they always do for anti-communists, will lie and make up stories. And it doesn't matter if they're professors or they work for the New York Times, they are professional liars. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioAryan.com.